Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, also available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. Today, I'm taking a break from the many wonderful workshops and craft lectures here at the 2013 Port Townsend Writers Conference to talk with Terrence Hayes, conference faculty member and amazing teacher whose students truly can't stop raving about him. His books include Wind in a Box, Hip Logic, and Muscular Music, with his most recent work being found in his new book, Lighthead, for which he won the National Book Award. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Happy to be here.
So as a quick reminder to our listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a new show here at Voice of Vashon with a simple goal of offering authors, specifically fiction, memoir, and poetry authors, an opportunity to discuss how they use their art to inspire social change or increase awareness in their readers. Terrence, I do find that authors have different ways of looking at this question, and I'd love to hear in your words what your hopes may be when you write a piece about the human experience or what you think about this.
My sense of social activity, politics, and a poem, they really start very much in the real body. So I try as an individual, as a grown-up, professional parent, artist, to be fully engaged in the politics of my community, working in prisons or protests when necessary, conversations with politicians. So I've done all that, and the reason I do it is because I do think it informs my work, but it doesn't make the work fully responsible for how I engage social activity, which is to say I feel free to go wherever I want to go mm-hmm. in the poems, because I don't really think of art as a place of action, honestly. I mean, it's very difficult to make art while being active. So if you think about right. that notion, you see the difficulties of being a political activist. It's possible, but an artistic activist, that is just kind of a complicated term.
So what I'm hearing is that you see there's the physical aspect, which involves action, and yeah. there's like a reflective aspect, which is where the art comes
sure,
out.
Sure, and it can make people think. I think it can make people feel. But mm-hmm. the notion that art sends people into the street, I think, is something different. Because then you get into terms like, you know, when the communists do it, we call it propaganda. But
right.
when we do it, it's not called propaganda. So I think those kinds of pressures, this isn't a response that says it's right or wrong, but it does say those kinds of pressures on the art itself seem to me to not serve mm-hmm. the art. So we can think of example, the Black Arts Movement, Neruda's political poems. So we know that there are ways that artists can impact people, especially mm-hmm. outside of America. We know that that's possible. But mm-hmm. all I say is it's not the pressure for art to only do that is unreasonable or maybe even unfair. But that art can do that is a great thing.
Well, I think I completely agree with what you're saying, in that the last thing we want to do is be sort of outcome bound.
Right.
You know, like limited or constrained. How can you be artistic if you are also limiting yourself to some endpoint outcome?
Right.
But at the same time, your work clearly expresses that active side
sure.
of your life.
Sure, all
and
of
so
it.
So people
yeah.
who aren't able to walk in your shoes or haven't mm-hmm. been able to do what you do or see the world as you see it, they're gifted with an opportunity to have a viewpoint that's not just analytical like nonfiction.
Sure. And I hope it affects them, but that would be the broadest sort of hope for a poem, that it does mm-hmm. help people, it gives people a few more insights, but to expect that people
right.
must respond is something else. And I always say, like, if my neighbors are fighting, do I go write a poem about it? Which I have a poem about domestic abuse in the next room, or do I
right.
go over and knock on the door, which is ultimately what I did. So
right.
I think that ultimately is what it comes down to, the choice between action and art. Action always takes precedent, because I mm-hmm. think that action is what art comes out of. So it's not mm-hmm. the opposite. It's not like, you know, art leads to action. I think mm-hmm. action can lead to art, especially for an artist. So to be directly engaged really does inform.
Right.
Versus like if you're a monk and you live in the mountains, maybe you don't write political poems. And I think
right.
that would be fine, too. Or you write theoretical political poems. And that's mm-hmm. fine, too. But from my perspective, as long as you're socially engaged and trying to be, you know, a good citizen, in quotes, I think that your art has to reflect mm-hmm. some of that, or maybe not. Maybe you don't feel that you have to do it because you live it. And so that's what I'm interested in, that the notion of walking down the street versus sitting at your desk or working at your easel.
And yet there are probably a lot of people who, what's that term? When you live through another person.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, it's empathy.
Right. And there are probably people out there who, for them, their life, for whatever reason, constrains them. They're not able to go out and experience vicariously. So they live vicariously, or maybe they act vicariously, or they feel vicariously. So, yeah.
Yeah, I would be skeptical in that regard. I do think empathy, people can feel something in response to other people. But like the notion of getting people to change their lives based on other people, I find that to be unlikely, really. So you just hope that they'll look a little bit closer. This is what I say in my classes, even like what we really want is engagement. So which is different from change. You just want people to engage your idea, even if briefly, the longer, the better. But beyond that, you know, everything else is just is hope, you know.
Right. Well, an attachment to an outcome. I mean, what very oftentimes frustration comes from having too many attachments to what you think is going to happen or expectations.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I'm going to jump ahead. I have a couple of questions here. I'm going to jump ahead to one where the premise of prose, poetry, and purpose is that my premise for it is that true deep change typically comes through the heart, whether a person has a personal experience that affects them and changes them emotionally, or and it's happened to me, where you read or see something that falls within the realm of art, and it affects you at a heart level. The idea that we can experience life in another person's shoes and therefore better understand their perspective. And so for me, I'm just wondering if you could share with us what perspectives you have chosen to share through your poetry with people. You know, you've mentioned you wrote about the abuse next door, or you know, you chose in the moment to go act, but then you wrote about it.
Right.
And so I was wondering, I don't know, do you want to jump right into a reading?
Yeah, I can find some things here that sort of give you, I have two choices here. I wouldn't call them short poems, though. Here's a kind of an inverted poem called Music to Interrogate By. And so it's two stanzas. The first one is italicized for one perspective, and then the second one is not. Music to Interrogate By. When they ask what you did when you found the man crouched at your door, his blood greening the steps, you will have to say he was not there, I did not see him. The noise spread to the edge of the state. You had no power, but what you had was the same color as power, like rain in the thread of a jacket. What did you offer, spitting out the name of your leader? Were there no bullets to trouble him? Was there no spell to blind him? When they ask what you did, when you heard of the prisoners, when you heard of the war against ideas, when they beat strangers from their houses, what will you say? Who cares about the fires beyond your porch? When the war spread the brothers and fathers, blood of your age, to the borders, what did you do? The children will ask. When the wafer of destruction lay in your mouth, and the men in charge charged men and sent men charging, when the field was charged, the oil at its heart, the burials cocooned, where were your feet, they'll ask, and what will you say? I'll have to admit I was one of them. I believed the holes would soon be erased. Our leader knew this, floating up a mountain on the backs of soldiers. I wanted only to be free, a cup of water, if not rain. But the war spread to the edges of the state. Narrow closets opened in the field. The petals were white as cuffs. What I had was the same as power, the dampness in the thread of an old jacket. There was something sad and unforgiving about our leader's accent, his short yellow tongue like a pencil with no eraser. When they ask or wonder without asking what I did when I saw the slick and shameful, the naked men hanging an inch from the ground, when they ask what I did when I heard of the prisoners, when I heard of the war against ideas, when they exiled strangers, what will I say? That's why God, etc., who said you need not arm your children nor send them off to war? Who cares about the past worn smooth by error and friction? The wafer of damage lay charged in my mouth, bleeding its oil. I walked the back roads of my property with one shoe untied and the other in my hand. So to me, that is a poem that's engaging politics, but it's also trying to think about the fallout of it. So more than the moment when it's happening, that moment mm-hmm. of like sort of being a part of a nation, there's all kinds of images in here. And this mm-hmm. book was written in 2010.
Mm-hmm. And that this poem, is Lighthead, this yes. is in the most recent.
And this poem in particular was written, you know, with Bush and thinking about the wars abroad mm-hmm. and thinking, like, what do you say to your children about your role in it? Especially if you're not a soldier, you're not a politician, you're just a citizen and sort of feeling like these decisions are being made really without your say-so. But when your children look back to, I mean, it would be the same thing as thinking about any sort of moment of difficulty in American history, so that you would say to your great-great-grandparent, where were you when the Jim Crow laws, mm-hmm. white or black, were sort of being enacted? Mm-hmm. And then the problems with trying to answer that, like saying, well, yeah, I was here, but what could I do? So the poem is sort of, even with the image of a shoe untied and trying to make mm-hmm. it down the street, and then the other in your hand, which is like, this is the shoe I should be wearing, to be prepared to go into this terrain. So to me, that is what I'm, it's not the only kind of sort of political poem right. I write, but I'm very interested in the psychology of that kind of moment, because right. that's, it's personal, but it's also something that I think that many people have to sort of acknowledge, like your capacity for acting when there's a huge state that acts, quote unquote, on your behalf.
So, well, and especially now, like post-Vietnam, I believe all of our wars have been without the draft. Mm-hmm. And so that question, I love that question you have in there. Mm-hmm. I can't quote it because the book's closed, but mm-hmm. About, you know, what do you mean, like, it's okay to not send your kids off to war?
Right, right.
You know, so many of us benefit from other people's sacrifices and the decisions of this government without mm-hmm. taking responsibility for it,
right.
without risking anything. It's a really interesting aspect yeah. of modern warfare.
And so what's interesting to me about, in a poem like that, and it does reflect my thinking around, again, activism and action, is that the children are asking the parent. It's not really talking about the state, even though it suggests, well, I am a part of the state with a capital S. Mm-hmm. But that becomes much more real to me as again, I use this word deliberately, as a citizen, like how I'm responding really mm-hmm. to my children, not to strangers, not to even ideas about solidarity, national solidarity, racial solidarity, gender solidarity. What I think is, you know, I have these people that are in my home that I'm responsible yeah. to. And the next would be even maybe my students would even come next. And then mm-hmm. thinking about how to engage them with all of their own sorts of perceptions about right and wrong. And so that just complicates the notion of like people when we hear, this is what I want to say to these people who have done this thing or committed this mm-hmm. crime. I think, well, you know, that's really, it's easier to go at people, but it's much more difficult to go at persons. And what right. I think poems allow us to do, maybe this is true for all art, but certainly poems allow for a more intimate relationship. And I go towards that, the intimacy of a poem, of speaking to someone, speaking with someone,
right.
rather than speaking at someone.
Yeah, yeah. It's like an invitation to join.
Like, yeah, to
hold
contemplate,
my hand and walk
to,
with me and let's,
to talk, yeah.
Yeah.
So
I love that point you make about, well, a girlfriend of mine, she and I, about 10 years ago, were sitting at a park and we just decided we're not going to use the word them or they mm-hmm. anymore in our conversations, because it leads to this sort of powerless, frustrated talking mm-hmm. about things beyond our control.
Right.
And we focus on myself and what we're going to do.
Sure, sure.
And it made life so much more pleasant to get rid of the thems and theys. So whenever we look around ourselves, the world is definitely sitting there waiting to offer us challenging and painful issues that really need our sincere and heartfelt attention. Just this past week, for example, many of us have been, well, many people have been very rocked by the outcome of the Trayvon Martin mm-hmm. case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how you see yourself potentially dealing with that issue in your future work. Is mm-hmm. it something you would touch upon? It sounds like you would, but mm-hmm. From the perspective of a poet in particular, what does that process actually look like when you're in the moment, something's happening, and as you would move forward, like maybe, I don't know, if you want to share with us.
Yeah, well, this is some of the problems I have, even with like a phenomena like Facebook. So mm-hmm. Facebook has become very frustrating for me in the fallout of the Trayvon Martin verdict. And not because, I mean, obviously they're my friends, a lot of these people. So a lot of their sentiments are sentiments that I share by, you know, definition, that sort of virtual community. But the frustration is that they're sort of just posted in cyberspace. Meanwhile, while I've been here, my wife and kids went in a protest down to the mayor's office, and they were there all day. And my kids were fully engaged. My daughter's 13 and my son is 10. So my biggest regret was that I wasn't there to sort of participate in that space. And there'll be other opportunities. But I do find, I don't know, I can't speak for other folks because I don't really post on Facebook. I just sort of see it. But it seems to me like that sort of energy, even to go to, you know, to get the process together, to go and then even take a picture and post it on Facebook, I even find that difficult because I just think about like the notion of being in the moment and being focused versus the notion of audience, which is what Facebook represents, like this sense that others will see what you have done. So that's, it just complicates the whole notion of political activity and political activism, given like, again, the kind of the presence of mind that's necessary in these things. So meanwhile, for me, like I won't read this whole poem. It's a longer poem, but these are the things that strike me. I heard on NPR not too long after it happened, an interview between a guy who he wasn't sympathetic to the side of the case that was for Trayvon Martin. And so in the conversation, he simply said, the guy said to him, and this is maybe like April or even March of last year, shortly after he was killed, the guy said, well, what do you think about this this outrage that people have? And this dude said, whenever there's a calamity, whenever there's something awful that happens, calamity pimps come out of the woodwork and start to paddle their own canoes. So when I heard that, and this is the interesting thing about being being an artist, being a person who likes language and a person who sort of reconciles what's happening. So I thought it was a really interesting sentence. Let me see, I'm going to see if I can read it exactly. Yeah, calamity pimps come out of the woodwork and start to paddle their own canoes. So there's a bunch of mixed metaphors in it. But I knew that I wanted that sentence. So the question is, what do I do with that? Do I build a poem responding to like the idiotic kind of nature of that question? Or do I build a poem listening to the sort of musicality in that statement? Because there is music. Even calamity pimps to me is a really interesting idea. So there was a time, I think, you know, in 1968, that I would not be able to sort of deal with that as a kind of like beautiful statement. I would only have to deal with it as a statement of rhetoric and a problematic statement. And so what interests me in 2013 and post-millennium is those things, trying to do both of those things. So I said, it's a long poem, and it's a poem about, you know, wigs, ultimately, about, you know, the metaphor of wearing wigs, of disguising ourselves and other people being disguised. But there's just a moment in the poem, which is really ultimately not, it's not a Trayvon Martin poem. There's dealing with, it's a poem that has Norman Mailer in it, and as I said, wigs, and then there's just a moment. It quotes Norman Mailer from his essay, The White Negro. No Negro can saunter down a street with any real certainty that violence will not visit him, wrote Mailer. Bullets shout through the darkness. Dumb people are dangerous. Calamity pimps come out of the woodwork and start to paddle their own canoes. This was a white dude's response to the death of Martin. Later, let's beat that apathy wig right off him. You know, so it's speaking to someone, it's speaking to a partner and saying, let's go get him. But in that passage, like even for me to be writing it and saying the response to the death of Martin, I never say Trayvon Martin. So it's like, is it Martin Luther King that's playing with the echoes there? Obviously, the Norman Mailer quote is a really interesting one in the context of Martin. But they're just juxtaposed. I'm not using the poem to explicate all of that. And in the line, you know, dumb people are dangerous, is meant to speak about like what happens with ignorance without saying who the dumb people are. But the notion is important. So that's, again, how I like to. So contemporary events, I don't police myself. I don't say because it was the sentiment of someone I disagree with, and that the sentiment was crooked, that I can't deal with it. And so the speaker in the poem is like, we're going to, you know, we're going to kick its butt, essentially. But I also have to say, I needed to have it in the poem because I thought it was such a wild, you know, sonic sentence that he said. So
yeah, no, it's sort of like ooh, I don't like what you're saying, but dang, I like those words. Yeah, that's interesting.
Calamity pimps, you know. Yeah. So anyway, so that's pretty much how I work. And so the Trayvon Martin case will show up. It keeps showing up. Sometimes directly, sometimes metaphorically. And it does because it's something that I'm thinking about. So again, I'm with my children and we're going to protest and we're talking about it. So it does have a presence in my life, and hence it's going to have a presence in my poetry.
Right.
But that's how I would prefer it. Never theory, never idea, but always rooted in something real is how I think about it.
It's interesting what you say about being present and sort of the how Facebook, you know, is so different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, last year? Yeah, last year I was involved in a number of Occupy marches.
Sure.
I took over a coffee shop in my community and did a big montage all about bringing Occupy to the people, because I kept talking to people about, you know, the huge difference between being in a march with 3,000 people and talking and seeing and smelling and walking in communion with people, and the difference between that and looking at the front page and reading a couple of paragraphs about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to like bring the physical, active experience to the people.
Sure.
So, and it's, you know.
I was in the Occupy march in Pittsburgh, and when they stopped to speak, a black guy who was homeless, who had been living down there, decided that he wanted to speak too. And it was interesting because he completely railed against the Occupy folk who had come down and taken over his typical living quarters. So to me, that's a very interesting moment because it's not a black and white moment. It's not a moment of like the clearly who's the trouble and who's not. Because here, all the really well-intending kids, the people that I was with, that group suddenly become like colonizers from this guy's perspective.
Yeah.
And to me, only art can really get at that. Like the media can't get at that because it's too complicated. They got 5-minute segments. But for me, art can really get at the complexities within a seemingly simple black and white story.
Mm-hmm.
So of the whole thing, that's what I remember. All of the speeches that everybody gave, there were a lot. All of the talks, I read something. People were milling around. But what I remember is a homeless black guy getting on the mic and saying, why are y'all down here in my space? And
I'm so glad he said that.
Yeah, it was interesting. And so,
no one
really knew how to respond. I mean, they were sympathetic, but also did that mean that they should leave the space and seem to kind of retreat from their mission as Occupy? As Occupy forces, because a guy's like, you're in my space and you're completely ignoring me.
Occupy was an incredible baby step forward for a lot of people who had not previously been engaged in in activism at that level or civil disobedience. It's definitely so. Real quick, I'm going to have to take a second here just as a quick reminder to our listeners. You're tuning in to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm talking today with Terrence Hayes. So, let's see. One of the things that I'm specifically focusing on with this show is working with fiction, memoir, and poems, and not with nonfiction. Nonfiction seems to be very direct. People will, you know, whether it's Michael Pollan or whoever it is, they know exactly what the person's talking about, the end of oil, the end of suburbia. It's very clear I have an agenda in a way of something I want to promote. But I find that fictional stories, memoirs in particular also, which is nonfiction, and poetry, almost always there's something really intense being shared. And in fiction, oftentimes it's underneath a veneer of this really pretty story, something that captures you and drags you along. But it's very rare for an author to miss a chance to make some social commentary in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like a roller coaster, fiction and poetry seems to spin us around, turn us upside down, and toss us off a cliff, but not for real. It's like we get all the emotion without the danger. And I was just wondering, since emotion change through the heart is so crucial, how does that play out for you? You know, how do you find the difference between getting stuck up in your head or feeling with your heart, or what does that mean to you?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I mean, I think that that is the bridge between, you know, what we're trying to do is to bridge what we think and what we feel. I think that may be the gesture of art. If you think about the balance between craft, which is what we think, and then the sort of the guts and feeling of the poem, shaping those two, reconciling those two seem to me a kind of ongoing challenge in the work. The question does sometimes become, you know, what are you shaping it towards, or who are you shaping it for? So what I often say to people is that, you know, when I'm generating a poem, I'm just trying to get words down and let them be what they are. And then only in the revision process do I begin to think about, you know, who do I imagine hearing this? And that's, again, not about change, but it is about listener. Like, is someone just overhearing me have an idea, or am I really trying to sort of engage people in ideas? And I was thinking of a poem that really, again, it's all my poems in this most, the book that's coming out next are too long to read in their entirety. But it's a question of thinking and feeling, this poem. And I think that this is a political poem too, actually. It's very much dealing actually with abortion. It's called Elegy Zombies for Life. Oh. And the setup is just people with the posters outside my home. I had a home on a corner of a busy intersection for a few years. And so people decided to set up their abortion posters there. So it's dealing with them. And then it sort of slides into this conversation of this jazz musician who didn't have children because she wanted to sort of devote herself to music. But the ultimate thing that sort of emerges in the poem is the trouble with living like thinking is feeling is it's not really living. So this idea of living like thinking is the same thing as mm-hmm. feeling, or conceptualizing everything that happens mm-hmm. becomes less real. And so the poem just play that notion out. So again, I say that to say that these are things that for me become the site of a poem, the sort of subject of a poem, these questions, more than they're real under the guises of having a poem really work that kind of question out mm-hmm. is what I would say.
You know, life ruled by emotion can be chaotic and mm-hmm. problematic, but life without emotion seems like becoming a robot and not really being alive at all.
Yeah. So it's the balance. And again, it's a balance that is necessary for art, but obviously the part of what the poem is sort of playing out, because the poem is sort of teasing both sides of that argument of the right to life, who zombies for life, Christians for life, you know, Muslims for life, like isn't everybody for life, who's mm-hmm. for death. It's that kind of, this is sort of what unfolds inside the poem. But again, what I'm really trying to show and demonstrate through all of the poems that I'm reading is that I do like that these kinds of complicated questions, these questions that complicate the things that we're told through media, are simple things. They're simple. You're on this side or on that side. And I just find that to very rarely be the case. So things like evil suddenly become very problematic. I feel like I even mentioned that in this poem too. There's a moment in the poem where I'm referencing this movie. And again, it just goes to the same idea. There's a movie, what's the name of this movie? Bucktown. So the guy shows up in the town. They're white guys that are bad guys. And this single guy decides that he's going to call in some of his old war buddies, mm-hmm. Black war buddies, and they're going to come in and get rid of these races. So they come in, they get rid of the races, and we think that that's sort of the end of the movie. But then this guy's friends decide, we like this town. We think that we want to be the bosses in the town. They come in from a bigger city. So right. I love that moment in the movie because that's real. Like, it's sort of like they like their power too. Nobody is completely altruistic.
Sure.
So now it's him against his friends who are trying to take over. And at the end of the movie, his primary friend, who was sort of had gotten in charge of these other, you know, the other homeboys who came in, he says to him at the end of the movie, what does he say right before the big fight? I don't want to kill you. I just want to beat the hell out of you. And to me, that's so great. That's so much more complicated than what we typically see in film. That feeling mm-hmm. of saying, you know, I actually don't want to kill anybody, but I do want to mm-hmm. beat the hell out of you. You know, mm-hmm. literally, like, get the badness out of you, and then we'll be friends again. So to mm-hmm. me, that sentiment, and that comes up in that poem, too.
Right.
Because that is really, to me, a more complicated and more human feeling about versus like saying, you know, an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie where we're going to now just kill them. We're going to annihilate them.
Because they're the completely evil alien that has no redeeming value. So you can feel okay about going out. Yeah.
Right. So to me, again, that's an opportunity for art. It's the opportunity for poems. And sometimes we were just talking about, I can't remember the name of this nonfiction book now, this memoir, and I won't even go into it. But sometimes in the memoir, too, it's an opportunity to complicate these things that seem less complicated when mm-hmm. you just get a snippet of it on the news.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, The media in particular loves to have polarized issues that provide nice, simple, you know, you can be here, you can be here, there's two options. It's sort of like the false choice idea out there, you know, and it's like, well, you know, actually, it's not a matter of do you do this or do you do that. There's this whole huge range in the middle. I talk about my life as being, I live the gray way. You know, I definitely live this middle path.
It gets especially complicated, obviously. Like, that is one of the complicated things of the Trayvon Martin case, because it does seem very much like a kind of clear sides in it. But I'd heard someone on a program saying pretty much what I'm saying here about multiple truths. So the guy just said it could be true that Zimmerman profiled him, and it could also be true that Trayvon was on top of him and beating him up, you know, like both of these things. But sort of the way that the law plays out, either you're guilty or you're not guilty.
Right.
And so that creates all kinds of problems for understanding it. And then when we have to talk about it in those terms. So it is a very simple, I mean, this is what complicates this kind of thinking. And I don't think it's a bad thing to have to sort of deal with that. So you look at it and then you try to say, well, is this guy, who's responsible here? Is it the state that I should go after and try to get them to change? Or should I be saying that this villain, this evil George Zimmerman is the problem? And I tend to not think that.
Or is it
I think
the law?
Right,
the
well, that's
what
I mean
sets
by the state.
That's what I thought you meant. Okay,
yeah. So it's like
I keep looking at this law and I'm like, oh.
Stand your own ground laws that sort of allow these kinds of things to happen, to allow people's fears to sort of
And put them out, you know, encourage them to put themselves in a situation where, one, they can make a horrendous mistake like that, you know, or possibly do something intentionally, or we don't really know. But it only happened because he felt, I have the right in this state to go and act in this way.
Yeah. And so on the end of that, you know, because again, who knows for any of us when we think about like personal judgment, what kinds of circumstances would lead us to make terrible decisions. So you do say, well, clearly the policy created this, and this is why we hope to have good policy and good policy makers, because when you don't, ordinary people, or even worse, like afraid people, scared people, which is, I think, what he was. And again, this is not a sin. It's not a sin to be fearful. A fearful person makes acts that sort of create the kind of weird space that we're in. So what we hope is that laws prevent these kinds of like ambiguities, these fogs that have sort of emerged.
Or combination opportunities, fear plus easy access to weapons plus a sense that your community needs you to protect them plus, plus.
Yeah. And, you know, so what I'm suggesting is that the system, the people in the system can always be dumb and flawed, but what you hope is that the system can hold them. But when it doesn't, when you have bad laws, it does allow, I mean, this is true for George Bush and Iraq too. Like, if you allow people who don't really know better to start making decisions that have power invested in them, this is what we get.
Or so, people but who are biased.
Yeah.
And
so
willing,
I'm not of the camp that says like hunt them down and do something to them. But I am of the camp of like, can we get rid of this law? Can we get them retried? I'm not even sure about that. Like the civil trial or the or the civil rights trial. I don't know what the outcome of all those things are, but I do think that it is. The state is what we can go after, and that's really what the action should be. But again, I'm just suggesting, like, in these moments when it really is, it is unclear what to do, and people are so sort of intense that you can't even really have a complicated conversation about it because an act has happened and a sort of injustice has transpired. So I understand that. But I do think that these are the moments for me that I turn to trying to make it into something tangible, which is a poem
or an
essay.
Or art has like, if we go analytical, you know, the brain gets in the way of so much because it drops off or does not include the empathy piece and the put ourselves in their shoes piece and all that flexibility that that I think art can contain both. So like, for example, I recently went to Eastern Washington and I my husband's Mexican. So when I hang out with people who are immigrants from Mexico, I'm usually part of this huge extended Mexican family. My husband's first generation immigrant, was born in Mexico. And so I'm that white, blue-eyed, blonde woman who's surrounded by this huge family, and so I'm completely accepted. I've been invited and married, and it's my family, you know, my sisters, right? I went into this grocery store in Eastern Washington, and I was absolutely horrified. I was by myself without my family, and it was like the white elephants trundling their way through the middle of that grocery store as, you know, the white people walked here and the immigrants who were there to pick fruit walked here. No one looked at each other. No one talked to each other. And I got wrapped up in that. And it floored me. And what I realized was that those people aren't going to be able to overcome that horrific situation. I couldn't live in that environment. They're not going to be able to overcome that with their brain alone. Heart is necessary. You have to be able to feel the love that mother has for her beautiful child, which caused her to risk a border crossing before you can discuss the issue.
Yeah.
And I see art as poetry in particular as somebody just really being able to evoke emotion in a subtle way, like catch people off guard and suddenly they're like, and they
see, that's
feel
funny
it.
Because, you know, I told you I was contrary because I do think that that's true, but that's secondary to like changing policies that like make people educated. So we need the laws to allow people to come in, the Dream Act and these other things, so that they can have a right to citizenship, which to me is not poetry. That's politics.
Right. Yeah, that's
and
up
then
here.
You educate them. And if in the classroom when they're getting a great education in math and in English, they encounter Shakespeare or me or whoever, and then they have sort of another door open up, but they just got to be there first. So like the question is that there will always be people who are the sort of custodians of our country, which is to say, you know, my grandmother was a cafeteria worker, you know, that kind of idea. So it's not like I'm not suggesting that everybody has to be wealthy, but I am suggesting that everybody should have, like, you know, a decent education. And so that, to me, when I hear those, like, divides, I think those divides are rooted in something like opportunity more than even empathy. It is just like, oh, well, because, I mean,
fear.
This is the complication of segregation. Like, the arguments are, well, and you know, in my circles, the arguments are integration was a terrible thing. Just let us be educated in our communities and get the best teachers for our communities and not have to go into like the white schools and suddenly be like second class citizens in that space. So again, that's a very complicated thing that interests me because I don't think it's either or.
Yeah.
But I know that these are the things that some of the like, kind of rhetoric of the Black Arts Movement was that like, you know, well, actually integration was a terrible thing. Assimilation was a terrible thing.
Rhetoric and so, of women's lib.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There are a lot of women who just felt like, oh my gosh, I'm not enough of a human being. If I stay home and nurse my children and take care of them, I'm lesser than. I have to go out and now copy a man and go have a man's job in order to prove that I can be a woman.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
So, you know, I do find those human complexities to be really interesting. But what I'm really suggesting is like when I hear that story of the sort of, I mean, part of that is a class, part of that is cultural. I always think, well, as long as if you're just fighting just to have a stronger education system in America, that would be like the most political thing you could do. And so now who do you blame? Who are you looking for? I mean, Republicans, I guess. But where do you go exactly to fight the notion that people should remain dumb? I mean, it's such a it bleeds into so many corners of our culture. But that really basic thing is like, oh, you're just trying to help people. It's not even enlighten them because that comes even before poetry. So, like, do you give poetry to people who for most of their lives have not understood the value of art or the transformative power of art? Or do you say, let's make sure everybody can do math, let's make sure everybody can read comprehensively, and then we will give them this art, quote unquote.
Right.
So, because otherwise you find, this is the notion of like a patronage, what you find is that you're making art for a certain privileged class that can afford it and has the leisure time to enjoy it.
To enjoy it, exactly.
That's Langston Hughes with his, it's true for Thelonious Monk too, with his patronage, the Baron. So the Baroness. So I find like those are complexities because my parents, you know, would be interested in poetry if they had the time for it, you know, that kind of thing. So to me, that's a question of education.
Just like some people might be interested in golf if they had the time
for
it.
Sure.
So in a way, you've jumped ahead to what I think was going to be my last question, since unfortunately we don't have forever to talk. But for all of our listeners, but maybe specifically for the young people who are growing into these convoluted and challenging times, I just wanted to give you a chance to share what hopes you would want to offer, or not, how do you say that? I had written, what hopes would you like to share with them? But,
well, I mean, I've said it.
You're already sort of talking. Like I said, you jumped ahead of me. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I think opportunity is a big part of it. And I think action is a big part of it. So some of that, I mean, the reason I read the poem, music to interrogate by is because you always come, if you are a person who is trying to be active and trying to be socially engaged and vote and go to rallies and go to city council meetings, what you find is that even when you're fully engaged, you will always be met with some frustration. Mm-hmm. So the irony is that is the system. That is what it means to be in a republic and a democracy, is that really it's not going to ever be one person or even a small group of people, unless they're, you know, Wall Street billionaires, that enact change on a system. Mm-hmm. So it can be frustrating. But that is, you know, like you know, the times that I've been at meetings and saw young people in the room, that's always a moment of quote unquote hope and excitement. But beyond that, I don't look at them just like I don't look at the people who are going at George Zimmerman. And I try not to look at George Zimmerman that much. I just look at, again, our sort of structures that we've set up that allows like a person to murder someone and go free, or a person to be extremely smart and go to prison. Mm-hmm. So those things share the same idea, which is there's a system that they're working in that's limiting them in ways that it doesn't limit everyone else. Like, you know, for me, it just so happens that I'm tall and I was athletic so that I could get to college. But short of that, I don't think that my going to college, you know, my parents dropped out of high school, I don't think that I would have gone. So it's just sort of genetics and luck. And we live in a culture that happens to like sports that allows me to be where I am. And so to me, that's completely random. I know lots of guys and women who are as smart and talented as I am, but, you know, not as tall.
Right.
And so not sort of enjoying the same kinds of luxuries of traveling around and reading and teaching at places.
Right.
So given that, when I say, well, what is the difference then? It is a systematic difference. It's not like, oh, they're less good than I am or less talented than I am or lazier. You know, none of that. It all has to do with just sort of the randomness of a system that, you know, privileges one kind of, you know, talent, which is maybe basketball, over another. So as I'm saying, that is it, opportunity. So it is engagement. It is trying to fix the system and not confusing the system with the people who are inside that system walking around. Mm-hmm. So that's the kids. The kids are like that. They're no different than anybody else, because you think, well, I just want you to get a good education. I can't do much more than that. You
know? Right. Yeah, well, that totally dovetails with sort of the work I've been doing. Is just my goal is to influence my readers to want to stay engaged or to recognize the value of engagement. Engagement does not mean that you're guaranteed a good outcome. You know, getting involved doesn't mean that suddenly you're going to solve all the problems. But I find that people who, I think, burying your head in the sand and trying to avoid it or ignore it is uncomfortable. And I think that being really frustrated and doing nothing is uncomfortable. And I think that doing something is an outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's writing something or walking in a march or...
Right.
So...
Yeah. And teaching helps. I mean, for me, the exercises that I do with college and graduate school folks are the same exercises I do with juveniles and prison systems, you know, and the outcomes are always provocative, is what I would say, you know, educated and not, if you give people the sort of right kind of avenues to express themselves. So that's what interests me, like, you know, getting people, again, some new insights, some new ideas, some new modes of expression is really what I can do as an individual moving through the world.
Right. That's so cool. Terrence, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This has been awesome. I'd like to thank you for listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, my new show here on Voice of Vashon. If you caught us halfway through, you've been listening to my interview with esteemed poet and writing professor Terrence Hayes. Check out his website, terrencehayes.com, to learn more about this amazing author and his award-winning work. Look for our brand new and snazzy website to be released this fall, 2013, at voiceofvashon.org, where you will soon find a Prose, Poetry, and Purpose tab where you can listen to archived shows. My name is March Twisdale, program host and producer, and if you have a favorite author who inspires you to believe in yourself and the future, who you'd like me to interview, send an email to marchpower@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. And now, special appreciations to Susan McCabe and Bill Wood for their initial enthusiasm for Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. Bob Moses for his help in selecting my beloved recording device, the Zoom H4N, without which this interview with Terrence Hayes would not have been possible. Michael Golan Johnson for all of his patience in teaching me how to edit my raw material into a finished show. And finally, many appreciations and heartfelt gratitude to my guest authors for their craft and their time. And now, here's our island's own Cami Lundeen and her newly released song, Run Free, one more example of inspiration through art.
Like the wild horse runs in the mountains, like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. Run free and be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides, hides inside, that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy night.